All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Wednesday morning. Just one day away from the start of the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium, 2 days out from hearing Fed Chair Jay Powell, speak virtually at that event. Joining us now to talk about the setup for Jackson Hole and what we can expect from the Fed on the balance of this year is Priya Misra, Managing Director, Global Head of Rates over at TD Securities. So Priya, let's just start with Powell's speech, and we can get into the tapering conversation later, but he's used his speech at Jackson Hole through his tenure to kind of talk about big picture ideas. Started with R-Star, I think that was the 2018 version, then kind of teased the average inflation targeting, I believe, the following year. What are you thinking about in terms of big themes Powell might be after here? And of course, we have gotten the topic of his speech already.
Sure. So the topic is economic outlook, and I think that's very important. I think what the market now is struggling with the rise in the Delta variant, is the economic outlook and how high are the risks, and are the risks all to the downside or are there risks to the upside and inflation? So I do think he's going to stick to that economic outlook, which is the title of the speech. But ultimately, it's a great point. Jackson Hole is not a Fed meeting. It is, where they do talk about longer term framework issues. And I think this is his chance to link the framework review, the flexible average inflation targeting framework that they launched last year, to the exit, to talk about how it's not inconsistent. They can taper at the end of the year. They can hike, well after that, we think late 2023 or 24. And that's all consistent with the FAIT principle. Not that they're getting spooked by inflation. I think just trying to put the exit in the context of the FAIT approach with the risks that abound, I think that's what we'll be watching for. I think market expectations have gone down from what we expect from Jackson Hole, largely because of the Fed minutes that were released last week. I think it's fairly clear that the Fed is leaning towards tapering at some point at the end of the year, and they're not in any urgency to taper. So I don't think now people, I think 3 months ago, people were expecting the entire plan for tapering to be announced by this week. I think those expectations have been pared back. But we'll be watching for really nuances of how nervous are they about the economic outlook and what's the process of the exit.
Priya, how nervous are you about the economic outlook? And then how is that informing where you think rates are going to go before the end of the year?
Right. So it is a big unknown. I think what this entire pandemic has taught us is, to be humble about figuring out the virus and the impact on the economy. I think not to sound too sanguine, I mean, we do see the rise in the Delta cases that is a downside risk to the economy. But we do think that each of these surges have had less of an impact on the economy, partly because the appetite for adding restrictions from the administration seems to be lower. The world is learning to live with the virus. So we do see a slowing in the economic outlook or GDP, but remaining very robust, and the labor market really accelerating. The GDP has outpaced the labor market, and now it's time for the labor market to catch up. So we've actually got a very healthy fourth quarter in terms of the economy, slowing from the first quarter in terms of GDP, but remaining strong above potential. And that's what will allow the Fed to therefore exit. So that's a big part of our higher rates call. I mean, I don't have significantly, I have 175 by year end on the 10-year. Is predicated on the economy remaining robust, the Fed exiting slowly through tapering and then hiking at some point, and more fiscal stimulus. We do expect that to come through. So, right now we're watching it. It is a downside risk, but as long as hospitalizations stay low, mobility doesn't fall off, we think the economy can actually weather this surge.
Priya, I also want to ask you about sort of the technical effects in the bond market, namely that we have seen such strong demand in recent auctions, treasury auctions, from foreign buyers. And so you have to wonder, too, if that is also going to help put a lid on rates this year, if that demand is indeed going to continue.
Right. So we do expect the foreign bid to remain strong. I mean, it's been a very uneven recovery, not just within the U.S., but globally. And as EM Asia is struggling with the virus surge, they're looking for places to invest. We also think there's been intervention from China, and all of that demand for dollars is ultimately ending up in the treasury market. So that should cap how high rates can get. But as the market starts to price in tapering, $120 billion of monthly buying by the Fed, as that goes down to zero at some point next year, the market starts to price that in. And that's why I think rates can rise, but there's a ceiling on it. If global growth, ultimately US treasuries, I think, are a barometer for US growth, but also for global growth, because it's the safe haven asset, it's the reserve asset, and money does flow from the rest of the world. It's one of the higher yielding sovereign bond markets out there in the developed world. So I think absolutely great point. It's something that should cap the rise. But, you know, can we get a 50 basis point rise as the market prices in tapering and a solid economy? We do think that there's room. It's just probably going to be a moderate move.
And then, you know, Priya, just finally before we let you go, are you thinking now at this point about any potential changes at the top of the Fed? Or are you guys just going to kind of take that as that comes in, as we get towards, of course, that February date when Powell's current term is set to expire?
Right. So I think we should hear by September, late September, October. I think we should hear what the administration's plan is. Hopefully, we don't have to wait until February to know the Fed leadership change. Our thought is that Chair Powell is likely to be reappointed. But in any case, even if he's not and somebody else is brought on, you know, the Fed has been extremely independent, credible. They've got this new framework, and I think we're going to hear more about how the framework plays into the entire tapering and hiking, that I think it may not matter, the Fed leadership change, but markets don't like uncertainty. Our base case is that Chair Powell does get reappointed. That's sort of what we're hearing from Washington. But again, it's unknown until President Biden sort of makes that decision.
All right. We'll leave it there. Priya Misra, Global Head of Rates Strategy over at TD Securities. Priya, always appreciate the time. We'll talk soon. All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Exponential Fitness out with its first quarter since becoming a public company earlier this summer. CBeat on the top line here for the company. Joining us now to talk about the direction of the business, the future, of course, of the fitness industry, Anthony Geisler, founder and CEO of the company. Anthony, appreciate the time this morning. Let's start with talking about the Delta variant, which I know you guys discussed a lot on the call last night, just in terms of impacts you've seen with respect to your business and sort of how you're thinking about, you know, really the robust recovery we've seen for the gym space, you know, over the last 12 months or so.
Well, yeah, thanks, Brian. We actually had our best month ever in the company's history last month in July. So Q2 was good. But we also, you know, gave reports on July due to the Delta variant to, you know, just kind of indicate where the company is today. So our system-wide sales was stronger in July than it was in February, you know, pre-COVID. So we're not seeing any meaningful impact from Delta yet. We're continuing to monitor it on a week-by-week basis. Even in, you know, cities like New Orleans or, you know, New York or San Francisco, where vaccines have been mandated, we see an uptick in membership. We believe that's because people feel more comfortable coming back into the gym. But, so far we're continuing to monitor it, but not seeing, any meaningful negative activity, from Delta yet.
Anthony, you know, that's certainly good to hear. Have you implemented a vaccine mandate for your, nine studios? And if not, are you looking at something like that?
Yeah, we have not yet. We're following all the, CDC guidelines and any, city, county, state mandates. But as a franchisor, these are all independently owned businesses. And so, franchisees have to follow, the guidelines in their cities and states, but we haven't mandated anything as a franchisor yet now.
Hey, Anthony, it's Julie. On a related note, what kind of feedback are you getting from franchises? You talked about how in some cities you're seeing an uptick because people feel more comfortable. It's been interesting. We talked about masking when there were mask mandates, about how restaurants, for example, were put in the position of policing it, or stores were put in the position of policing it. What kind of feedback are you getting about your franchisees policing vaccine mandates and checking cards, for example, at the door? Are they finding that challenging?
Yeah, the whole, COVID situation is tough, right? Whether we were having to, police masking or police vaccinations, we're doing the best we can. Franchisees are doing the best they can, to check vaccine cards in the cities where required to. You know, obviously there's, you know, labor issues and things like that as well that are, you know, across the United States. So, you know, franchisees are doing a great job. They're, you know, checking vaccine cards and, you know, any systems that they have. They're all a bit different in every city. Some cities have, you know, QR code capabilities, some do not. But there's only three cities that are really doing that today. So it's not, you know, given that we're in 48 states and we have, you know, such a mass spread across the United States, it's not a company-wide, you know, situation that we're having to worry about at this point.
And Anthony, as you've seen folks come back to your locations, which brand is outperforming others and why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, like there, you know, it's not on a brand by brand basis. It's really geography, right? And so is, you know, Florida opened up earlier, Texas opened up earlier, California and, you know, New York City opened up later. The recovery in those cities or states, you know, are longer, right? So it's not on a modality by modality basis or, you know, vertical by vertical. It's really geographical, you know, and what we see in the recovery.
One key to your story, and I mentioned it before we came on, I'm losing track of how many studios you are opening. How many will you, in fact, open this year? And are you still on track for a longer-term vision or a target of 6,900 studios in the U.S.?
Yeah, we're still on track. We are, you know, we're not losing count here, but you know, it definitely continues to grow. We have over 1,850 locations across the country. You know, since January of 2020, we've actually opened 354 new studios and sold 554 new licenses. So, you know, we sold 197, almost 200 licenses in Q2, just this last quarter alone. So people are definitely still getting into the business. They think it's a great investment. You know, 103% of our active paying members have, you know, returned to the gym. So we're, you know, we're seeing that number continue to grow. And people are confident in what we're doing. And so we just continued to run our play and stay on track.
And you know, Anthony, just a final one here on just the fitness industry, right? It's a business of trends in terms of what people want to be doing to get in shape. And you said something interesting on the call. You said you're in the early stages of looking to expand the portfolio into HIIT, functional training, high volume, low cost fitness modality. I have some ideas around what that might mean, and maybe there's some brands you don't want to mention, but I'm just curious what you're seeing in terms of, you know, what you think your both franchisees, potential franchisees, and existing customers, you know, might want to be doing in terms of, you know, their time in a studio or in a gym.
Yeah, those are the, you know, kind of three outstanding modalities that, you know, Xponential doesn't own. Obviously, our latest acquisition of Rumble earlier this year put us, you know, back, put me personally back in the boxing space, but the company back in the boxing modality. And so we're, you know, we're excited about that. And those are the, you know, the three, you know, kind of opportunities for the business. And so we're talking to, you know, multiple brands in, you know, functional training and in HIIT, and, you know, continue to expand the portfolio.
All right, we'll leave it there. Anthony Geisler, CEO, Xponential Fitness. Anthony, appreciate the time this morning. We'll talk soon.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Executives from the technology industry as well as other leading American businesses are set to head to the Capitol to meet with White House officials on the issue of cybersecurity. And joining us now to discuss is Ann Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology with the NSC. Ann, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. I'd love to just start with how the administration today is thinking about the threat of cybersecurity, given the incidents, you know, we've seen over the last couple of years, and sort of what you guys are hoping to get out of today's conversation.
Thanks so much, Miles. It's great to be here with you today. So we certainly see that the country is facing malicious cyber activity, and it's affecting everyday Americans. Ransomware attacks, small, large businesses, and government agencies as well. You've seen the president, his national security advisor, has really put a focus on this issue. The president issued a far-reaching executive order in May. He launched an industrial security control systems initiative that rolled out security across, you know, 150 electricity utilities. But the government can't do it alone and really needs the partnership of the private sector. So we've invited key leaders and key companies from four sectors: technology, insurance, banking, critical infrastructure, and education, to talk about some of the core issues, and there'll be an exciting set of announcements coming out of the summit today as well.
Hi, Anne. This is Dan Halley. I'm the tech editor at Yahoo Finance. I wanted to ask what you think specifically some of these companies could provide for the federal government, and if you want to be able to discuss with them local governments as well. I know they've been hit particularly hard by some of these cyber attacks and cyber intrusions.
Really, thank you so much, Dan. So our focus is not on government uniquely. Our focus is really on whole of nation and how to really improve U.S. resilience. So the core question we have for tech companies is, how do you bake security in? So when you and I buy a car, we buy it with airbags and seatbelts in it. We don't have to figure out how to configure it securely. We don't have to pay for it separately either. So our goal at the tech companies is to say, how do we build more secure software and hardware across the sector? It really builds on the president's executive order that mandated certain software standards for critical software that then lifts all boats because we're all using the same software. So that particularly is the discussion with technology companies. And then related to your field as a tech editor, the second tech-related conversation is really with the insurance companies. You know, insurance motivates us to, for example, install smoke detectors in homes. So our question is, how can insurance get companies to patch rapidly, to put in place strong incident response, to share information about incidents? So that's the second part of the holistic approach to saying, how can we use tech more securely?
I guess, you know, when you look at how some of these companies, not necessarily the tech companies themselves, but the companies that use their services, you know, there's so many disparate industries, so many important industries that rely on them, but they all manage their own cybersecurity capabilities on their own. So I guess, is there a way for the government to say, look, you know, outside of the critical ones that have already been discussed, such as pipelines, is there a way for the government to say, these are the requirements that we need you to have in place to ensure that we don't see future attacks that could put people in danger?
Exactly to that point, it's a really great point. The president rolled out a national security memorandum for all of critical infrastructure just a couple of weeks ago, and that asks DHS's CISA and Commerce's NIST to build voluntary security controls. So to essentially set our expectations for critical infrastructure owners and operators who are in the private sector. Those will be voluntary, but we're communicating clearly, and the president did so in the National Security Memorandum to say the security of critical infrastructure and ensuring that Americans have the benefit of critical services protected from cyber threats is our priority. We're establishing these voluntary security controls and really asking critical infrastructure owners and operators to meet them. At the same time, you know, where the U.S. government does have the authorities to mandate them. And a great example was TSA's recent mandates for pipelines. The government did mandate that for pipelines, building on the lessons learned and the experiences we saw during the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack.
And it's Julie here. I want to ask about data, because part of solving this issue or making progress on this issue is getting your hands around what the issue is. Right now, companies don't have to tell you when they have a hack. A lot of the time it's leaked. Maybe they tell you because they've decided to. They don't have to report it to the government. This is something I know that Congress has considered. It's my understanding that the administration has not yet come out in favor of some sort of reporting requirement. Are you making progress on that front, or are you changing your mind on that? And if not, why not?
You raise a really interesting point, Julie, that malicious cyber actors can use the same technique again and again to compromise companies and government agencies. And if we could share information about those techniques quickly, we could potentially prevent next attacks as well as, you know, particularly for criminals, bring those individuals to justice. So we're very much behind more effective incident sharing among the private sector and back and forth in both directions with the government. Indeed, in the president's executive order, we use the authority we had to mandate and say any companies doing business with government must inform us when there's an incident. And really our goal was enabling us to take that information and share it broadly across private sector and government to protect. I know there are some bills on the Hill and we're watching those closely. We very much believe in effective incident sharing, and we also very much believe in leaders' accountability across the private sector for what occurs on their networks and for putting in place the cybersecurity practices that could really reduce the risk of a successful attack and, as you noted, compromise of a lot of personal data.
And I just want to ask, you know, as far as patching, right, we know that That's one of the biggest things or ways to protect against hacks. But so many companies don't do it or don't realize that they need to do it. You know, a lot of companies kind of look at cybersecurity spending as an add-on. Is there a way that the government may say to, you know, outside of these critical companies, right? Because yes, the critical companies are obviously important, otherwise they wouldn't be critical. But there are so many other businesses that are just as important but don't have these kinds of requirements. Now, is there a way that the government is discussing with these kind of, you know, regular everyday companies about how to protect themselves, about making sure that they apply patches, have cybersecurity best practices to ensure that the information of regular Americans isn't just lost as we see on a regular basis?
You're really hitting on a core issue, and we want to take that issue on in two ways. First, we'd like to see tech built more securely so there are fewer patches. Building security in from the bottom up so that there's less pressure and less, frankly, the responsibility isn't the responsibility of the user to keep their system secure. It's built that way from the ground up. So that's piece number one, and that's a core part of the deep dive session that will follow the president's discussion that the Secretary of Commerce and the Small Business Administrator will lead. How do we build tech more securely? And then the second part, which is to say, how do you incentivize and ensure companies patch? How do you make it as easy as possible? First, we see great work across DHS and CISA doing information sharing, sharing the techniques that adversaries are using to encourage companies to patch and stay secure. But the second part of that is really why we brought in and invited the insurance companies, because we felt that they could incentivize those practices. For example, if you could only get an insurance policy, if you've put certain cybersecurity practices in place, and if after an incident, you know, before you could get a payout, you had to show, for example, that you'd patched critical patches within a very quick time period of the incident, perhaps that's a way to incentivize that. So that's some of the discussions we want to talk about, as well as others. So we can really address the core issue you're talking about, which is how do we ensure that the information that we rely on, the services that we rely on, are protected to meet the level of the threat, which has only increased.
And Julie here again, just one final question. I guess I'm struggling with why we don't make them do it. I know that this is a cordial meeting that the president presumably will be having with these executives today. You're talking about incentivizing, you're talking about nudging, you're talking about sort of soft power. I mean, we're talking about really critical data here, not just on a personal basis, but on a national security basis, on infrastructure basis. And it just feels like we're sort of tiptoeing around making people do what needs to be done.
Yeah, so the U.S. government, Julie, does not have the authority to mandate security practices for U.S. companies, full stop. Where the government has the authority to mandate that, TSA and their emergency directive for pipelines, we immediately did that following the Colonial Pipeline incident. In other core, there's some bespoke areas where there's state-level mandates. Those are increasingly being placed as well. But bottom line, the U.S. government does not have the ability to mandate that. The president's national security memorandum, where he outlined voluntary security controls, was a big step towards there, where we essentially said, here's our expectations. We're putting you on notice that this is what we expect, and we're going to start the conversations with Congress on the Hill to say, given, just as you said, Julie, the critical services, the critical data, we believe these need to be mandated, but let's start the conversation. Traditionally, over the last decade, when the government has looked at mandates, there's been strong pushback from the private sector because of concerns, and because of the expectation that companies would voluntarily move there to protect against the threat. I think, as you say, it hasn't happened with the speed or the threshold of effectiveness in terms of cybersecurity that we need. So while first, as I noted, using all the authorities we had to mandate those, we also laid out those voluntary controls and stated we're going to start those conversations to see what additional authorities may be needed to meet the threat.
All right, we'll leave it there. Ann Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. Yahoo Finance's Dan Halley. I appreciate the time from both of you this morning.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. We've got another company reporting earnings to watch today. And Intuit had seen a pretty nice pop here off those results. Top and bottom line beat for Intuit, the parent company of TurboTax and QuickBooks. The company reported revenue of $2.56 billion for the quarter. That was up 41% from a year ago period. It also got quite a bit of a boost there, $405 million in revenue coming from the recently completed acquisition of Credit Karma. And for more on that quarter and the results there, I want to bring on the CEO of Intuit, Sasan Goodarzi. He joins us right now alongside Yahoo Finance's Brian Sozzi. And Sasan, good to be chatting with you again today. Congrats on the quarter here. Not only did you top expectations on both lines there, but you also upped your guidance. So talk to me about what you saw and what gave you the confidence looking forward.
Yeah, well, first of all, Zach and Brian, thank you so much for having me. You know, I would just say that we are really experiencing some digital tailwinds from folks shifting to engaging in a virtual world. Excuse me, more and more folks that are accelerating their adoption of online offerings and omnichannel. And then last but not least is we're seeing an explosion of folks that are really using platforms to manage their money. And so if I translate those digital tailwinds into what we're seeing, the teams have done an amazing job innovating for our customers. And so our customers are using more and more of our virtual solutions to do their taxes and run their business. And this is both TurboTax Live and QuickBooks Live. And secondarily, we're seeing a really strong comeback with Credit Karma, where we serve well over 100 million customers, and we're able to help them personalized offers for financial products that are right for them, whether it's credit cards, personal loans, auto insurance, you know, free checking and savings accounts. And then last but not least is, you know, small businesses, I think more so in the pandemic, recognize that using a platform, in particular in this case, QuickBooks, to be able to run their business allows them to power and fuel changes in their business model, getting paid faster, being able to grow customers in different ways. Mm-hmm. And if I put all those things together, that's really why we're experiencing the acceleration that we just announced yesterday at earnings.
Sasan, I was talking to someone who follows your company closely, and they mentioned to me they're starting to see some pretty large synergies between TurboTax and Credit Karma. What are some of those synergies unfolding right now?
Yeah, Brian, that's a great question. You know, the way we truly think about the company and talk about the company is really we are one platform. And, you know, very specifically, we have launched Credit Karma as part of the TurboTax experience. So if you're doing your taxes or you're having an expert help do your taxes for you, at the end of the filing experience, you can deposit ultimately your refund on a Credit Karma money platform. And then you can not only get a free checking and savings, but you can get early access to your paychecks. You can get access to financial products. And the reverse is true. You know, we ran a number of experiments and launched TurboTax as part of the Credit Karma platform. So if you're on Credit Karma, you know, leveraging the platform to do the things that I mentioned earlier, like watch your credit score, are you paying bills on time, what financial products that are right for you, we'll contextually make you aware of your tax situation, and ultimately you can get your taxes done while you're on the Credit Karma platform with TurboTax, whether you choose to do it yourself or you have somebody do it for you. And we just actually announced launching Credit Karma as part of the payroll platform so that an employee can ultimately put their direct deposit on Credit Karma money and ultimately over time be able to get early access to their paycheck. So you didn't really think about Intuit as a platform company that's focused on the benefits that matter most to customers. And we're leveraging the assets across the company to accelerate benefit delivery for all consumers, self-employed and small businesses that we serve around the world.
Really sounds like a completely different company compared to last time we talked to you about 5 or 6 months ago. Now, you do have an investor day coming up next month, I believe. To the extent you could, what is the longer term top and bottom line growth rates? What do they look like to you inside Intuit compared to, let's say, how the company has grown the past 5 years?
Well, you know, we're building on a 37-year foundation where, you know, we've built capabilities where we can truly operate as a platform company to deliver the benefits that I just shared with you. But at the same time, we have a lot more leverage now because we're building services once that can be deployed across all the offerings that I shared with you a moment ago, building them with APIs so engineers can build on those services very, very quickly. So it gives us the ability to, one, accelerate our innovation, but also have, you know, operating margin leverage. You know, to be very specific, our innovation, you know, is up 2x compared to a year ago. And last year, we were up 2x compared to the year prior. And we measure that by code deployments and impact, while at the same time, we're investing in all the areas that we believe is critical, but our operating margin also expanded. And that's the leverage of a platform company. So, you know, we provided, as you said earlier, great performance, great guidance moving forward. And we believe over time we can continue to accelerate the growth of the company, just given that we are truly now a platform company.
Yeah, on top of that, I mean, you talk about the acquisitions, investing in the company. You're also stepping up your share buybacks here. $1 billion of stock in fiscal 2021, an additional $2 billion cleared by the board there. I mean, when you talk about maybe the best use of capital here right now, are there other opportunities you're looking for beyond, you know, Credit Karma to add to the suite and really, you know, I guess grow some of those synergies you're just discussing? Or is this the best way to go? You also boosted the dividend, too, by about 15%.
Yeah, well, you know, we have very clear financial principles in the company that we follow. And really, our first financial principle is to grow revenue double digits. And we want to grow operating income faster than revenue. And that's where the platform leverage comes in. But all of our really excess cash goes to investing organically into the company. And then if it makes sense, where we have capabilities where we want to accelerate, we'll look to acquisitions. And then, of course, we'll look at things like, you know, dividends. So we have very clear prioritized principles. The number one thing that we are focused on is delivering for our customers and accelerating growth. And just as we did with Credit Karma, we will make acquisitions that align with our strategy, a culture fit where we can really propel ourselves forward sort of 5 to 10 years, which is what Credit Karma did for us. And we're excited about having Credit Karma as part of the family and the opportunities that it creates for customers.
Really, Intuit, Sasan, has a great pulse on the health of small businesses in this country. Given where we are in the pandemic, what is the health of small businesses?
Yeah, you know, Brian, I'll just cut it quickly by geography and industry. I'll start with the U.S. I would say the U.S. has bounced back, you know, quite nicely. And in many aspects, when we look at our data on our platform, and that's acquisition, retention, charge volume, the number of employees that small businesses are hiring, it's really bounced back to pre-pandemic levels. But and when you double click on that, it's really dependent on industry and states. You know, there are some states that have, you know, recovered much faster than other states. There are industries, more service industries, which is where we serve, have bounced back a lot faster than retail, you know, whether it's restaurants and so on, which have, you know, have experienced what it takes to be shut down and then open back up. Last thing I would say on the U.S. is, you know, when we look at our base, although small businesses have recovered, about 20% of our customers, their net deposits is down more than 20% compared to pre-pandemic levels. So great recovery in the U.S., but really there's more to be done to ensure that small businesses are back to the health that they experienced pre-COVID. I would say internationally, it's a little bit of a different story. You know, Canada is a couple of notches behind the U.S. in the recovery. And then most of the other countries that we're in, U.K., France, Australia, just to name a few, they are really much slower in recovering, both the consumer and small businesses, because those countries have been opened up, shut down multiple times. Mm-hmm. And it's really impacted the confidence level of small businesses where, you know, if they're in product-based businesses, they're not building up their inventory, they're not hiring employees because they're just not sure if they're going to be shut down again or not. I'm confident they'll recover once we get through this health crisis, but they've just been much, much slower to recover than the U.S.
Yeah, the question there still remains about some of those that were dealing with the stop-start. How many are going to be still standing after all of that as well? But you know, we'll be watching that. Sasan Goodarzi, the CEO there of Intuit. Appreciate you coming on here to chat with us again alongside Yahoo Finance's Brian Sozzi.
Thank you for having me. Take care. Well, bye-bye.
Well, major cities are starting to require vaccine status for indoor diners, not just here in New York, but we've seen that as well implemented in New Orleans and San Francisco. Raises a lot of questions about what restaurants can do to ensure that they are, in fact, verifying their diners are vaccinated. And OpenTable, the reservation giant, teaming up with Clear, cybersecurity firm, most popularly known in airports there, teaming up to make sure that it's easier for their patrons to show their vaccination status. And for more on that partnership, I want to bring on the president and CTO of OpenTable. Joseph Essis joins us right now alongside Yahoo Finance's Alexander Canal. And Joseph, it's interesting. I think a lot of people watching the show know Clear as the expedited airport line. Of course, security at JFK may be a little bit more strict than what you might find at a Denny's. So is OpenTable, you know, profiting off the partnership, or was this something that restaurants you partner with were seeking because it's become difficult to really tease out who's telling the truth here?
Yeah, nice and good to be here. So we definitely don't profit from this at all. The whole motivation here is to allow restaurants to do things in an easy way. So as a pandemic hits and as new regulations come in, new mandates around if you need to show your vaccination proof as you go to dine indoors, we just offer an opportunity for diners to have a very easy way to do that without thinking about it. Not don't have to carry your vaccination card with you, and for restaurants to an opportunity to kind of verify you and tag you inside our system, saying you've been verified for entry.
Joseph, you have 432 restaurants on the OpenTable platform right now that are requiring proof of vaccination, but you guys have said that you seat over 1 billion people across 60,000 plus restaurants, wineries, and eateries. So percentage-wise, this is still pretty small. When you talk to your restaurant partners, what are the pain points of this? And for those that are unwilling to require proof of vaccination at this time, why is that? Is it fear of losing business, lack of staffing? What have you guys been hearing?
So that's been interesting. I mean, all these new features that we're launching for restaurants, restaurants have to opt in into them and kind of check the box to say, I want to participate in this program. And we just launched it, you know, very, very recently, and we already have hundreds of restaurants who are playing in that. And some of it is a reflection of mandates, you know. So if your restaurant operating in New York City or San Francisco, you have to do this. And so they have to obviously say, we want to do it, and they have to check the box and say, let's do it together. Now, from the diner side, I think the feature is compelling as well, because as you make a reservation, you get all the information you need to know when you go to a restaurant. So the expectation is set that I have to show the vaccination record, and there's no kind of unpleasant surprises as you walk in. So I think it works both from both sides. It works quite well.
Yeah, we're just showing here our results. It's interesting because it looks like your guys' results were a little different when we asked the same question when it comes to would you be willing to kind of go to a restaurant where you got to show it for entry. Our results were overwhelmingly that people would not want to go to those restaurants. Your results, 72% said they're very willing to dine at a restaurant that requires proof of vaccination. Of course, these are probably different sets of the population we may have been polling here. But when it comes to that, on what you're hearing on the reservation side, right, on the restaurant side, since people watching this can make up their own minds whether or not they want to go in for vaccination. I mean, what are you hearing from the restaurant side in implementing this and really being able to do this in a way that's easier, I suppose, since restaurants are already grappling with enough?
Right. So we look at the data from various kind of directions, I would say. We don't see a massive drop in traffic into restaurants or in reservations into restaurants in the cities that mandated those vaccinations. So which means folks are probably not as worried about it. Also, our polls are conducted among the diners who actually go out to eat in those restaurants. And like you mentioned, you know, 70%+ of them said they have no problem going to restaurants. In fact, they would feel good about going to restaurants knowing that it's a safe environment. So in some cities, there's definitely somewhat of a drop in demand. In other cities, there's not as much. Hard to say is related to this new mandates or not. We've been looking through it, and some of it is seasonal. Some of it is weather-wise. You know, there's been obviously bad weather on the East Coast. So we'll see. We'll watch it carefully, and we'll know in the following weeks, like, what's working, what's not working.
And let's talk about the security aspect of it all. Recently, there were reports that data from COVID contract tracing apps were leaked. And I think overall, there's just been a surge in data hacks. We have a White House event later today that will be discussing all of the cybersecurity threats that we've been facing. So how do you ensure that users' public health information is not leaked or exposed?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we obviously looking at every opportunity to make sure that everything is safe, not just that you feel safe going to a restaurant, but also your information is safe. And so we partnered with Clear because I think Clear is a company that are true experts in identity and security and connecting secure information to your identity. And we don't want to store health sensitive information. And so Clear specializes in that. And so in this case, a diner that comes in, if they have a Clear app, their vaccination card is right there. If it's not, we prompt them to download it. And so all the secure health information has been stored on the Clear side. From OpenTable side, all it is verification, essentially. Somebody just checks that I verified this person that they can enter the restaurant given all the regulations.
It's a very interesting question around all that, since, you know, some of the times, anecdotally, just hearing reports of fake vaccine passports, as well as, you know, people maybe not checking the names on all these things, obviously Clear, a bit of a higher hurdle to jump through there than maybe what we might see on the front lines at some of these restaurants. But Joseph Essis, OpenTable President and CTO, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today alongside Yahoo Finance's Alexander Canal as well. Thanks again for the time.
Welcome back. President Biden is holding a White House summit on cybersecurity today with an A-list group of tech titans, including the CEOs of Amazon, Apple, and Microsoft. We know the stakes are high here after a string of high-profile attacks this year alone, including the Colonial Pipeline hack, which threatened to cripple critical American infrastructure. Here to talk about it is Kareem Hijazi, CEO at Prevalion. Kareem, good to see you again. Earlier today on Yahoo Finance Live, we had Deputy National Security Advisor for Cybersecurity, Ann Neuberger, on, and she was talking about today's summit and said that the U.S. government cannot mandate what private companies do with regards to cybersecurity. Given that, what do you expect to come from today's summit, if anything?
Well, we all have hopes. And unfortunately, you know, I'm among many of my peers that sort of say that the playbook keeps getting repeated over and over again, that is a little bit old and tired. And it's focused on vulnerabilities and patching and things like that, which are absolutely essential, but they're far from the actual problem, which is that the adversaries we're dealing with, the level of sophistication and how dynamic they are, has facilitated already a compromise effort. So rather than suggesting there's vulnerabilities that need to be patched, we should be addressing this latent embedding of these actors that are actually able to open doors whenever they want. And unfortunately, we're screaming this from the private sector side. The government isn't leaning as forward on this as I think we'd hope. And the kind of leadership they're bringing to the table, understand it on a sort of broad level, but not at the technical detail that I think is necessary. So I'm a little bit reserved on what I think may come of this.
Does the current bipartisan, it sounds like you don't think the current bipartisan infrastructure bill goes far enough in putting in place the tools that the public and private sector need to combat these attacks. If you were in that room today with all of these folks at the White House, how would you guide them?
Absolutely. I think it's a good start. And I think the biggest problem that we're seeing here is, again, this misperception that we're still in a potentially vulnerable and yet to be attacked state, when in reality, from all the data that we collect from a Prevalion perspective, suggests that we're already in a compromised state. And now it's about rooting out that evil internally so that those doors can be shut from the inside. Because the problem now is that it's no longer what it was 10 years ago, where there's hackers pounding on the outside of the gate to get their way in. They're using phishing attacks, they're using very sophisticated means to hack the people of these companies and these governments, which then afford the adversary the means to act like they're authorized to be there. So there's very few defensive technologies that afford any defense against that. It takes a new breed, a new generation of looking at this from an insider threat perspective, meaning the malware is resident. Let's find a way to root this out. So my hope is that this can be kind of accelerated and the sophistication of the conversation can move to the level that the adversary's at. So we're literally bringing a knife to a gunfight in these conversations. And I really wish we could kind of get on par with what's really going on out there.
Yeah, good analogy. So let's break down what some of these bad actors are up to, because when it comes to disruptive malware, you say ransomware is not the only game in town. There's something called wipers. Please tell us what that is.
Certainly. It's a very concerning situation, because ransomware was very alarming. And I think it kind of hit everyone like a ton of bricks, because it was going to be extortive and it was going to get people to pay money if they didn't, you know, do certain things within a certain amount of time. Now what they're doing is they're going further to either steal the information, which is extortion as well, but even worse, nation state actors like you know, Iran that are a little bit more emotionally motivated in their attacking. They're not as cunning and as calculating. They'll simply just destroy the data. They'll destroy the machinery upon which it resides, and they'll do things simply to disrupt and destroy. They won't be financially motivated like what we've seen so far. And what that represents for us in the longer run are things that have actors that have very little motivation for financial gain. They don't really care about getting caught. They're there to essentially, to be a brutal analogy here, but they're there on a bit of a suicide mission to simply deploy something that can destroy infrastructure, critical infrastructure, water treatment facilities, electrical grids, and then just watch the carnage ensue. And that's the part I think that we haven't seen yet. And my hope desperately is that we get ahead of that before it gets to that point. Money loss is bad enough. You know, cyber attacks that manifest into physical or kinetic attacks is far worse.
What about the ongoing impact these are having on our supply chain? I mean, we saw it with SolarWinds, we saw it with Microsoft Exchange, a whole bunch of other companies are going through this. Are we just at the tip of the iceberg there in what these hackers can do, the damage that they can cause to our critical supply chain?
Very much so, Alexis. The bigger challenge here is that we've relied on a very old modality for figuring out how secure our partners are, which is to ask them and essentially get some sort of assessment from them directly, or maybe scan them. And what I mean by that is assess whether they've got vulnerabilities that could be exploited. The real issue is much deeper and ingrained, which is that the actors, these threat actors, know exactly what these ecosystems look like. They'll know exactly which supply chain partners exist as sort of a hub and spoke approach. So if you get that one supply chain partner, that'll afford you access to many prime contractors that you might want to get to. So it's sort of a one-to-many ratio that they can use to bounce around. We saw that as a one attack that manifested into many. And so the reality here is that we've got to change our paradigm and our perspective that these supply chain partners are these weak points that can be leveraged and exploited by these bad guys. And then they can sit and wait until the right time exists for them to move in when vigilance has been, you know, has waned and there isn't quite the level of, you know, vigilance that needs to be there. You can't constantly be vigilant. We all know that. So unfortunately, they wait for that moment. They wait for holidays. We saw the situation happen with, I think, Kaseya during the 4th of July weekend. It's all strategized. It's all planned. They know exactly when their skeleton crew's on site. So we've got to change our perspective that this is going to be an attack that will find its way in magically one day, and think about it that it's already here. When are they going to activate it, and how are they getting that communication into this company to give directives to this malware, what I like to call electronic spies that are already resident there? That's what we got to catch and remove before things get worse.
Right. And another playground for these bad actors could be the emergence of 5G, because the capacity for higher, faster wireless speeds also has a downside. And we know the telecom companies, including our parent company, Verizon, continuing to roll out 5G. What are some things they should be thinking about as they continue that push?
Absolutely. I mean, with any kind of efficiency and speed comes additional security problems, because, again, the problem is that the effectiveness of the product for our convenience is exactly what the adversary exploits to their advantage. So the speed by which they can deploy malware, the speed by which they can extract information from huge, broad swaths of environments that were otherwise unavailable, 5G and space internet, used to be, phone services were terribly slow in the old days. Remember, we'd have to run home to our cable modems to get a decent connection. Now, arguably, our phones are faster than our home networks, and 5G will actually accelerate that even more. Same with some of the more modern satellite technologies. So that provides a much broader method for attack surface for the adversary. And then it also allows the adversary to use other victims as another launching point for an attack. So it becomes a force multiplier for them to get to everyone and anything they want to get into. So what they need to be thinking about is essentially how to throttle connectivity to some of these groups, understand where these groups are, understand who's infected, so they can, to use the term that we've been hearing about for 2 years, quarantine effectively some of these infected parties so the contagion can be limited. I know it sounds biological, but it's identical in cyber.
All right, Kareem Hijazi, CEO of Prevalion, thanks for being with us today.